You know what's a lot more fun than thinking about how to best pay off student loans? Thinking about how rich you're going to be one day in spite of your student loans. That's why we started the Financially Free Era podcast. Financially Free Era, if you search that term on any podcast platform, you're going to find it. It's hosted by my colleague Megan McGuire over at SLP Wealth. And this podcast is where we dive deep into all the things you want to know about how to be wealthy one day. How do you best maximize tax loopholes and write-offs? How do you best invest money? How do you make smart money moves in spite of even a very large six-figure student loan balance that are going to get you where you want to be much sooner? Go follow the Financially Free Era podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. I promise you, if you like Student Loan Planners podcast, you will love Financially Free Era by SLP Wealth. Search that term, follow the show, you will love it. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast. It's Travis. Today, I'm going to do something a little bit unorthodox for the show. We did a really interesting tax webinar with our head of tax at SLP Wealth, Sim Terwilliger, and me. And we did it just for our SLP insiders and for our SLP Wealth clients. But I thought it was so good, and I thought that it is so relevant that it would be, frankly, better for me just to share the recording of that webinar for today's episode than to do a whole spiel about taxes and talk about taxes just by myself. So instead of doing my usual student loan planner episode today, I thought we would just share the recording of that webinar, and I hope you enjoy. All right, Sim, do you want to kick it off? Could you introduce yourself and let people know who you are?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. So I'm Sim. I'm one of the founding partners here at SLP Wealth. I am also our director of tax. I'm not just leading tax this year. I'm also doing tax preparation and planning myself. And so just for fun and not to judge anybody, I've been keeping a little notepad of mistakes I've been seeing through tax season. I'm only like 25% of the way through my client load. So I'm wondering, you know, how many more of these we'll see, but I just kind of jotted some of these down. I think it'll overlap with some of the questions we're getting today.
That's great. A lot of people are asking about separate versus joint. At a high level, Sim, could you talk about separate versus joints and things to consider?
Yeah. So I'm assuming that most of you guys are student loan borrowers, or at least one of you is a student loan borrower. And so with student loans, you kind of have one of two paths that you're going to take on how to deal with them. You're either going to pay those things off, or you're going to go for some type of forgiveness. And when you're going for forgiveness, they're calculating your payment based off of your AGI, your adjusted gross income, which you can find on line 11 of your 1040. So when you file jointly, you're probably going to have a bigger line 11, which is going to result in a bigger student loan payment. So we're always thinking strategically and legally, how can we keep line 11 as low as possible? And one of the biggest ways that we have is by just excluding your spouse's income. And you do that by filing separately. But there's this big asterisk next to what I just said. And the rules kind of change a little bit if you live in what's called a community property state, which I think a lot of our listeners today do. That's California, a bunch of the states on the West Coast. It's 9 states. But the rules for married filing separately in those states is kind of weird. What they do is they take everything that everybody earned. When I say everybody, that's why they call it community property. Like you and your spouse are the community. And they take everything that you guys earned and they split it in half for the most part. There's always exceptions to these rules. And so when you do it that way, that also presents some planning opportunities for some clients where you have maybe like a high earning physician and a stay-at-home parent, maybe the physician's the one who has the student loans. That's going to really lower his AGI, right? He or she is going to split their income and move it to the spouse. They're going to have a lower income on paper. They're going to get a lower student loan payment. Sometimes it hurts the spouse. If you're like the lower earning spouse, now your tax return is showing a higher income. Well, we have strategies for that. We have alt doc of income, right? Using a pay stub or something like that. But that's high level, right? And this split has to be done correctly. You have to do it on form 8958. And that's one of the mistakes I jotted down. For clients who did not work with us last year, they might be a new tax client. We always look at your prior year return. We're looking to see, what did you do? Are you doing carry forwards? I can get really technical, right? But we're looking at what happened last year. And a lot of clients, go ahead.
I was just going to say, before we talk too much about 8958s and things that make people's eyes gloss over, just one story that you'd let me know about is one of our preparers helped somebody correct a self-filed return in a community property state where they did that MFS split wrong. And they like did it in a way where they like overpaid by $20,000 in taxes, I think the number was approximately, because they didn't do that split correctly.
They didn't split it right.
So the thing about student loans is there's definitely more complications, right? Like we have some clients that you would describe as like overachievers. And then the idea of like filing an extension for their taxes is like, what do you mean I'm not going to turn in my taxes on time, right? That's like so important to me. What do you mean you want me to like delay it until September, right? At a high level, when we file extensions for people, right, a lot of times it's strategically because of income-driven repayment certification timing, right? Right now we're seeing Department of Ed only processing people who have said, yes, take my IRS information. Alternative documentation and a lot of clients that we're seeing is just like sitting and processing, waiting them doing something. If you just became an attending physician, filing that extension could like save you thousands of dollars, even a month, because you're essentially using that older tax return instead of turning it in on time. Let's say your IDR recertification date's in July, you file the extension, then you turn in your tax return in September, October, you get that lower IDR payment, right?
They always use your most recently filed tax return within the last 2 years. So strategically, yeah, for a lot of our clients, 2024 was a lower earning tax year. So it's just better to have that on file. The extension can also be strategic for other reasons. Like if you're waiting on documents, we have a lot of overachievers like, no, I have to file on time. We file them and then they find out, oops, I got this 1099 that I didn't report. Now I have to do an amendment.
Yeah. And there's some reasons why you might want to file on time for non-student loan reasons. Like, for example, somebody wanted to buy a really nice new house and they needed to get proof of income and they wanted that tax return, I think, because they were self-employed and they needed to show a certain number of years of income to be able to get qualified for the mortgage they wanted, right? So there's all kinds of like nuance sometimes when it comes to this stuff. Sim, one idea that I had real quick is I thought I maybe would show our MFS calculator spreadsheet. This is on our student loan calculator that we use both for consults and for SLP Wealth clients. And, you know, I do have to throw out the disclaimer that this is not tax advice. Consult your tax professional, which may be us, but, you know, this is not personalized, just, you know, educational purposes only, all those usual disclaimers, right? But one kind of interesting way to illustrate the community property thing is, let's say you've got one person earning $400,000 a year and one person earning 60, right? So like maybe a physician married to, say, a public school teacher or something like that. And if they live in New York, which is not a community property state, boom, they are paying a ton of extra taxes, almost $20,000 extra. So this is
Let's talk about this scenario, because sometimes this absolutely makes sense to do. Like, why would someone do this? Well, because we have another workaround too, file and amend. So maybe they go ahead, they do this, cry, pay the extra $19,000 to get a low student loan payment. You have 3 years to amend your return from separate to joint. There's this really corny, I think it's a fun expression in tax world. You can make up, but you can't break up. You can go from separate to joint, but you can't go from joint to separate. A couple could do this. They can, you know, pay more in tax now, get a lower student loan payment, and then get a refund within the next few years.
Right. And, you know, just to show the impact of the community property part, if you have that community property status, so like you live in California, Texas, et cetera, you change that from no to yes, boom, that cost goes from $19,000 in a year to about $1,000 just from additional Medicare tax, essentially. It's a pretty big deal. If you're in a community property state, it lessens the impact of married filing separate penalties substantially. Now, there are other things that come into play too. ACA subsidies you can't really get if you're doing married filing separate. That's something that's relevant. Folks under the age of 13, that's kind of relevant for, and also daycare expenses.
Dependent care credit, FSAs. You can take that.
Yeah. Higher ed deductions in some cases. Roth IRAs. Can we talk about Roth IRAs for a second?
Okay. This is like, if you can have like a favorite mistake or a top mistake, this is the biggest mistake that I've been seeing, is Roth IRAs not being done correctly back to a Roth. So basically with a Roth IRA, regardless of how you file your taxes, there's income limitations. If you earn above a certain amount, they don't let you put money into the Roth anymore. Several years ago, some financial nerds figured out a very legal workaround called the backdoor Roth. And so if you file separately, that AGI limitation is like $10,000. And most of our clients earn more than $10,000. So if you're married filing separately, you probably cannot contribute directly to a Roth at all. And even if you file jointly, your income may still be too high to contribute directly to a Roth. But a lot of people contribute to a Roth and then they find out, oops, I wasn't supposed to. And if you don't correct it on time, now you're subject to a 6% tax every year until you fix this.
Yeah. A lot of times people that need to file separately for student loan purposes, they might be kind of early bird gets the worm kind of people. And they've already done the direct Roth contributions and then need to recharacterize to avoid problems later, because you need to do that traditional non-deductible contribution, right? And then convert it immediately to the Roth IRA.
And then you have to watch out for if you have any pre-tax IRAs. Did you ever roll over a 401k into an IRA, a simple IRA, a SEP IRA? Because then you have this weird problem called the pro-rata rule. And to keep it as high level as I can, The IRS is looking at all of your IRAs, like one big IRA. They're looking at what percentage is pre-tax, what percentage is after-tax. If you do a conversion, you're going to get taxed on that conversion, which in a way defeats the purpose of doing a backdoor Roth. And it's avoidable, by the way. And we kind of talk about that when we do financial planning. But top mistake I'm seeing, even with like our clients.
Yeah. Some other topics here. So adoption credits, that's a big thing. Like if you adopt a child, you can get into a situation, depending on AGI limits, where you cost yourself a bunch of money from that. Medicare is an interesting one too. Let's say you've got two people making $150,000 and somebody's on Medicare. Your Medicare premiums, your IRMA basically, your income adjusted Medicare payments, your premiums on Medicare basically get higher at certain AGI levels if you're filing taxes separately. And that's very relevant for people like, especially parent plus borrowers.
Parent plus borrowers, yeah.
Folks like that. There are some small business considerations. So like because of QBI limitations, right? If somebody is a dentist, for example, and they're jointly under a certain AGI limit where they get to claim the writing off 20, you know, a big chunk of their business income because of the QBI deduction, you lose that in some cases. That's the main stuff. The good news is you can amend from separate to joint. Our position on this, generally speaking, is one of caution. We kind of like to amend only if it's going to save you a certain amount of money, right, Sam? Like, I mean, you
Our threshold internally is like 2,000. If you are going to save 2,000 or more, we'll probably reach out to you if we prepared your taxes to let you know, hey, you may want to consider an amendment.
And we track this for clients. And I think the thing is like, if somebody's going to save $1,500 and it's going to cost us several hundred dollars to do all the work to amend it, then it's like, is that really worth it? Like, is that really worth extra letters from the IRS and having to like potentially paper sign something? It's in some situations, right? Like, is that juice worth the squeeze, so to speak, right?
Yeah, just to comment on that, doing this strategy is perfectly legal, but the IRS is looking at it and they may think, was this really you? It can trigger like identity verification notices or other notices for the IRS to, you know, verify certain information, which doesn't mean you did anything wrong, but those notices, I will tell you from seeing with our clients, people can find them very distressing because the IRS feels like a scary entity.
Oh, I hate IRS notices. I get a ton of them because they have multiple different entities for all kinds of reasons, right? And my favorite ones are the ones where they send you like eight pieces of mail and you're like, oh shoot, what did I do? And then you open it up and it's like, we've received confirmation. Your mailing address has changed. And it's like, dang it. Why don't you put that on the freaking front of the envelope? Hey, this is a mailing address change. You know, you have nothing to worry about. You know,
you want to make sure you open it. If you're scared a little bit, you'll open it, right?
Well, I think the problem with the IRS is it's very underfunded, right? A lot of the rules, well, it's going through a lot of turmoil. And there's also a lot of rules that are just like, they don't make sense. Like one of the rules that I hate is the solo 401k 5500 easy rule, which says that if you have more than $250,000 of assets in your solo 401k, if you fail to file a form 5500 easy, it's a $250 fine per day. So if you make like some kind of reasonable mistake and all kinds of different tax stuff, the consequence of doing something wrong is very expensive, even if you were well-meaning. The good news though, Sim, is what do we generally find for honest mistakes that don't involve like lying, like underreporting?
I mean, honestly, maybe this is a hot take, but I feel like the IRS is generally very reasonable. Like if you get a notice, just respond to it. They'll give you a deadline, respond to the notice. And it will take some time just because they are operating on a skeleton crew, but usually these notices will get resolved.
Yeah. I mean, I had one of the scariest notices I had ever was because of an address change in my business. Something was going to the wrong address. And for whatever reason, the address for the particular entity didn't get changed correctly. And so I was getting multiple notices, but they weren't arriving to me. And it was just on some sort of like misallocation where a estimated payment was applied to a wrong tax year, basically. And I finally did get the final notice, which was like, you know, it wasn't like we're going to come kick your door down, but it felt like that. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, we're going to explore seizing bank account assets. I was like, what? What do you mean? I didn't get any of these notices. And so I worked with, you know, my CPA at the time to just essentially just make a reasonable reply to that. And everything worked out fine. I think one piece of advice is like, if you don't report income, you go to jail. If you make an honest mistake or maybe are too aggressive on deductions or something like that, you know, that's more of like a civil issue, right? So I think that's the general thought.
Speaking of notices, I would much like if a client emails me and like, Sam, I got a notice. I'm like, please let it be the IRS and not from California. FTV,
yeah.
Much worse. They have very broad, so is the IRS, but the California will go after you for a much longer time. They'll pursue whatever you owe for like 20 years. IRS is 10.
Well, I think that's one thing people underestimate is a lot of times, like, people think, oh, like, I can do my own, and you can do your own taxes. But, like, I think in my mind, the thing that often makes it worth it to hire somebody is the state agencies or even local entities, right? Because those are not run the same way as the IRS. A lot of times the competence of these agencies is much lower, in my opinion, than the IRS. And just the weirdness is greater. So I'll give you one quick example, Sim. The trigger for me hiring a tax professional was when I lived in St. Louis. They had multiple different types of, like, wage taxes, earnings taxes, like payroll, like all kinds of nut stuff for just like a fairly small city. I was just like, I will pay double the amount of taxes for this to be simpler. You know, I mean, it was terrible. And then one year, the IRS didn't audit me. It was the city that wanted to audit me. The city government wanted to audit my books or something like that. And my local, like, CPA literally called the collector of revenue's office. And he's like, so-and-so's my client. They're good. You don't need to audit them. And he sent me back this email. He was like, hey, I got you off the hook for the audit. Like, I just told him no. And I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Like, that's nuts. You know what I mean? Like,
I would never work for California.
I mean, states are certainly a level of sophistication above any, like, local entities, probably with the exception of, like, New York or something like that. But I think in general, like, the notices that people get from state governments can be a little scary sometimes, especially for the married filing separate, the amendments, the community property. We basically have one notice that we pretty much call, like, the California notice that goes out a lot of times when people do
married filing separately. Pretty much every time I've seen almost every California notice I've seen with our clients is them not understanding their own rules with 8958, and they're not doing the split. And they're like, hey, why does this income not match what we received on the W-2? And it's like, because we split it according to the community property rules of your state. And they're like, oh, okay. And then they back off. But we've had maybe 10 of those I've seen.
Yeah. Well, so we've got other questions here. So I'm going to answer a couple of these questions. So yeah, married filing separately, doing backdoor Roth is okay, but not direct Roth, right? Yeah, that's right.
You do need earned income, though. You still need earned income to contribute.
One person says, do you do planning tax prep services for non-planning clients? Unfortunately, no. What we found,
by design.
Well, what we found, to be fair, tax tends to be either a high-touch, high-relationship business or a volume business. It's generally one of those two at most firms. And if you are a volume business, you are very likely, they're very likely going to miss things. Not to say that you can't miss things at a higher-touch business, but the volume business, like the extension planning, the separate versus joint analysis, right? The helping know how to respond to certain kinds of these community property notices, stuff like that. That's not their business model. Their business model is pay me a few $100 and leave me alone. On the other side, the high touch businesses, basically a lot of CPAs are being told, go up market, get richer clients, go after people with more complexity that you can charge more, right? And those CPAs in a lot of cases charge tens of thousands of dollars a year. And they really want to work with as few people as possible because tax is a very challenging business. And we've certainly found that, like, we are leading more in the high touch integrated relationship planning kind of side of things. And so for that reason, we don't have the capacity essentially to take on clients that are just looking for that tax only piece, unfortunately.
I also think we wouldn't do as good of a job. And I'll give you an example of how we add service. We're not just doing tax prep. I was looking at someone's 1099 DIV, right? This is a form that you get from a brokerage account. And I think in a high volume situation, the tax preparer just takes it and then they put it on the return and they move on. I read the DIV and I saw that this client had 2,600 in capital gains distributions. That is not good. That is activity it's very technical. It's activity that's occurring within a mutual fund. But basically that told me she did not have a tax efficient portfolio. We reached out to her. We're going to reposition her entire investment strategy. And all of this because I looked at her 1099 DIV, I saw her investments and that she wasn't doing what made sense. And this was her tax bomb account for student loans. Like, you want that thing to grow. You want it to be in the best position possible for when you need it.
Well, I mean, Travis's big three, look at Schedule D. Schedule D is carry forward losses. It's where you do tax loss harvesting. It's where you put all of your carry forward losses that you weren't able to claim from prior years because you didn't have enough gains to claim them, right? So if somebody doesn't have a bunch of carry forward losses in their Schedule D, it means they're not doing tax loss harvesting. It means that they're under-optimized on their taxes. Another thing, backdoor Roth IRAs. I always chuckle with Sim about this because it's like we have so many people that want to lease oil and gas trusts and wells and get involved in Airbnb and, like, do all these complicated tax strategies.
Real estate syndicates.
Yes, but then you look at their 1040 and you see they didn't do a backdoor Roth IRA. And it's like, come on, let's at least focus on the vegetables first before we get involved in, like, chocolate spice and things like that. And then the other one, big one, is donation of appreciated shares. The one that I like to use for my own personal donor advised fund is is DAFI. And I like this a lot because essentially what you're doing is you're taking appreciated shares, things that have gone up in value, and you donate it to your donor advised fund, which is the house, the central housing facility, if you want to think about it like that, of all your donations. And then you donate from the donor advised fund to all the charities you want to donate to. And that's a really great strategy because instead of donating like $10,000 to charity, like your church or something, whatever your charitable goals are, you donate the appreciated stock, you get a write off the gain, you take the cash that you would have given the charity, and then you invest it at a much higher cost basis on the investments so that essentially you're going to be able to use that money in the future without as much tax consequences, right?
So that's, you can also consider bunching those contributions. We have a number of clients that are like right at the cusp between standard deduction and itemizing. Can make sense to do a couple years worth of those contributions instead of doing it every year. And, you know, maybe every other year you'll do like standard itemized. But that's tax planning.
Yeah. Okay. A couple things that are like niche things. There is a loophole that I think will be available under the RAP plan when it becomes live for people who make five figures filing taxes separately who both have student loans. So, Sim, at a high level, the way this would work is let's say you've got two teachers married to each other and they're both going for PSLF, right? If you file joint, you are over the 100K threshold and you're going to pay 10% of your income under the RAP plan. But if you file separately, it's possible that you could be under the 10% of income threshold, right? That you might be able to pay 5 to 6% of income if you're two public school teachers married to each other. And that could save you as much as a few $1,000s a year in student loan payments. So that's like a kind of a cool five-figure income each kind of strategy that I've been thinking about for filing separate versus joint. In other cases, if people have both have six figures of income in a household, you know, the filing separate situation is best if only one person has most of the debt, right? Versus both of them having the debt. And then just for fun, let's talk oil and gas, you know, leases and short-term real estate and stuff like that. What are your thoughts on that? Why do we get questions about that so often?
So we get these questions typically from very high income earners because truthfully, they do pay a lot in tax and that's very painful. And so these are people who are thinking of what are ways I can get big tax savings fast? And that doesn't exist in my opinion. But with these types of investments, I'm a financial planner at heart. So my goal is to grow your net worth. And when people are talking about these investments, they're talking about depreciation or depletion and losses. And like, look at all of these losses I'm taking. I'm like, that's not great. You're letting taxes dictate your investment strategy. We want to grow your net worth, right? If your investment's losing money, that is not good. But a lot of people are letting, you know, what's that expression? The tax tail wag the dog or whatever. But that's the idea, is that you're taking losses against income when you normally wouldn't be able to take those losses because they'd be considered passive. There's certain exceptions, certain tax rules you can take advantage of.
One way to illustrate this from like the obvious kind of case is like, okay, let's say you've got a dentist with a practice and like, hey, I've got too much income. I don't want to pay so much in taxes. I need to get something that I can deduct this year. And so you go buy something. Well, it's like if that thing didn't add value to your practice, then that was like, and okay, you deducted it. You save 40% on taxes, but you lost the other 60%. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's still a loss. And if you buy an investment that is underperforming compared to like another asset class long-term, then that tax loss is not going to necessarily help you. And actually, I think what's interesting in my mind about some of these short-term rental loopholes is my bigger concern would be the lifestyle impact that it would have on somebody. It actually, I think, can work really well for certain kinds of couples. Like we have a friend that is very active on the, you know, kind of that kind of strategy. And she follows the letter of the law. She's hyper organized. She does it well. But it's like you've got to spend at least, I believe it's 500 hours and more than anybody else in the team, right? So if you have cleaning people, or you can't have a property manager for that short-term rental loophole, right? So it's like,
yeah, you're talking about the material participation rules for rep status. Right. There's different criteria.
Yeah. So I've thought about this myself for my own family. And the way I look at it is like, I don't want to spend 1,000 hours a year managing Airbnbs. I know my wife doesn't want to spend 1,000 hours a year managing Airbnbs. So like you could save some money on taxes if one of us did, but that's not how I want to spend my time. You know what I mean? So I think that if you had a spouse who was like super into real estate, loved the idea of managing properties, was just an absolute rock star for like handling complaints and online reviews and encouraging those reviews and marketing the property, and doesn't mind traveling to and from that property sometimes for different kind of purposes, right? So it's just, I think it's sort of like many things. People hear about it, think it's a great idea, and it can be, but I think it's oversold, right? Like a lot of the things that I get online sometimes are these ads for courses for short-term rental loopholes, oil and gas trust kind of things. Keep in mind the fees in a lot of cases of these investments are really high, right? So there's a big incentive for whoever's pushing it to try to get you to do it. Same thing for like real estate syndications, right? Like high fees, there's a big incentive for the sellers of it to try to get you to do it. You know, if you look at a lot of these syndications, a lot of them have underperformed public markets in a big way. A lot of these alternative investments, in my view, kind of come more from a position of pain. The pain is I don't want to have to do clinical work my entire life. I want to create a passive stream of income that I can eventually rely on when I don't want to keep working anymore, right? That is the very real pain. And then sometimes I think it comes out of a sense of boredom. I'm bored with my job. I'm bored with being a specialist that knows extremely well how to do this particular procedure 1,000 times a year. And I just want excitement in my life. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think there's anything wrong with being involved in alternative investments, but I would argue don't do it from a tax perspective. Do it because you want that lifestyle. You want that dopamine rush of owning your own Airbnb. You know, you want to try to pay for some of the cost of the mountain cabin you want to buy anyway. That would be maybe a more good reason to look into that for most people. Obviously, some people are going to have unique circumstances.
I always tell people to make sure you're doing the basic things first before you try to get complicated. I'm not against real estate as part of someone's portfolio, but people who are asking me this are also not maxing their HSAs, their 401ks. I'm like, this is really easy tax savings. That's passive, right? So do the basic things before you try to get complicated.
Yeah. One thing I want to say is if anybody has any specific questions, right, or concerns, comments, fears, hopes, dreams, whatever, I would encourage you guys to send Sim an email directly, sim@slpwealth.com. So one thing, ironically enough, is we're not trying to sell you today to become a tax client because we don't have the space. We have grown a lot as a company from a tax perspective. Like, I'm really proud of Sim's leadership. I think she's got things going in the right direction for where I want it to be, which is to be best in class for people who, you know, have student loan and taxes and the complexity surrounding that being their main thing that they're trying to figure out. My goal today was, you know, for our tax clients, we do a broad overview. Just in case you still want to hear from us on tax stuff, we wanted to do it for you. For SLP Wealth clients not having us do taxes this year, you know, we just wanted to do this to talk a little bit about what people are experiencing, what we're seeing with tax season. And then for the SLP insiders, we just wanted to try to provide you, you know, just some insights, some things to look out for if you're DIYing your taxes or working with a tax professional already. You know, we've talked about some of the big ones, right? The watching out for doing your backdoor Roth correctly, making sure you've recharacterized it. If you did it directly and oops, didn't do it and you need to fix that. Sim, obviously it's not too late to make IRA contributions and solo 401k employer contributions, right?
I encourage it. So for backdoor Roths, you have until April 15th. I wouldn't recommend doing it April 14th, but you still have some time. Solo K contributions. If you're filing an extension, that could be a good use of a strategic extension, right? If you want some time to figure out what you can contribute, that's your deadline to make the contribution. Otherwise, it's going to be April 15th. And you can still make the employer one, by the way. That's a weird calculation. It's kind of circular based off of, you know, roughly 20% of your Schedule C net profit. But yes, you can still do those. And I recommend you do it. And then I wanted to comment on what you said, Travis, that we're not looking to add clients right now. We are full. If you're interested, we can add you to our wait list and reach out to you when we have more space.
Looking at a couple of the questions here. One person says that my student's going to have a low income, you know, when they graduate. Should I sign up for RAP? It's hard to give a broad answer to this. In general, yes, because the RAP plan incentivizes a lower percent of your income if your income's lower, right? So like for 45K, I believe it's 5% of income, something like that. So for a 45K income, that's a pretty modest payment and it subsidizes the interest. So the interest is not going to grow on you. If somebody's got a modest balance, they have a modest income, the RAP plan can be a good plan for people. So that would be my kind of high level thought on that. So let's see a couple other things.
Yeah, because I have a few other mistakes to point out, but I think a lot of people are interested in this MFS, so we can keep talking about that. But I have a few other things I've noted for this year.
Okay, yeah, give us your no-no list.
Your filing status is determined by what was your status on December 31st. So if you were married, even for one day, then you cannot file a single. And yet that is a mistake I've seen a couple of times now where clients are like, hey, we got married this year, and they filed a single. Can't do that. You have to do married filing separately or married filing jointly. So that's one that costs them a lot of money too, because the tax brackets are different. This one, hot take. Lots of people I'm seeing this year getting large refunds. Some of them are five figures. I've had probably 4 or 5 clients already getting like five-figure refunds. That is bad. I know it feels good. You're like, dang, I'm going to like use this money. Maybe I'll do a backdoor Roth now. That means you gave Uncle Sam a free loan throughout the year. That's money that you did not have in your high yield savings account. That's money that you weren't using to like go to Chipotle and get the guac on it. You know what I mean? So like, do a tax planning meeting. We want to check your withholdings, especially if you had any transitions during the year.
In other words, you don't want a huge tax refund, right?
No. Personally, when I do tax planning, I like to keep my clients within the $1,000 range. You don't owe more than $1,000. You're not getting more than $1,000 back. I think that's good tax planning.
But it's obviously like Christmas in February though, Sam. What are you talking about? I like big refunds. It's so fun.
I like earning interest on my money. So
yeah,
Uncle Sam, unless they're late and getting you your refund, they're not paying you interest for that money that you gave them. That is your money that you worked hard for. So,
which is non-zero now. It used to be zero basically, right? But it's, you know, you can get decent savings account interest now.
Yeah, it's not nothing. But the point is you'd rather keep it in your pocket than let someone else borrow it for free.
Yeah.
And to that point about tax planning being important, if you have a transition, like if you're getting a new job, you're going to be making more money or you're making less money. Maybe you took like a parental leave. We want to account for that. Multiple jobs. So we've had several clients that have switched jobs and those two employers do not talk to each other. Employer A does not know what's happening at employer B. So we've had a few clients that have 401k over contributions, which is not a big deal, but it's annoying. You have to do some paperwork. You have to fix it or you're going to be paying taxes on that every year until it's fixed.
All right. Any other big things?
Which are the big ones so far? I'm going to just kick a dead horse with the backdoor Roths because another mistake is not just people not doing it correctly, but also not reporting it correctly. You have to do form 8606. I've seen a number of clients where they did not have 8606 at all, or it was done incorrectly.
We've seen people that reported their backdoor Roth conversion completely as income with no cost basis and essentially reported like $14,000 of like straight up income to the IRS as like an early distribution. I think they were paying like top ordinary rate plus 10% penalty, all because they didn't fill out the basis of their conversion. Right.
Correct.
So it's like, yeah, DIY tax prep might be like $100, but if you cost yourself more money than a tax firm would save you in potential mistakes, obviously that ROI makes sense.
Yeah.
The way I look at it now is like when I was poorer, I was cheaper because my time wasn't worth as much, right? Like me spending a couple hours on my taxes was like, what am I going to do with that time anyway? Play video games? I mean, like this is like early 20s, right? But as the value of my time went up, now like any time I spend on taxes is time I don't get to spend with my kids. I don't get to spend it on other more profitable business stuff that more my time is higher value. And I still collaborate with my tax person, right? But it's like, I try to make that high impact time, right? Another thing I want to point out too is get the right tax person or firm for like your number one pain point. We are not the best option currently for somebody who needs an S-corp return filed for a dental practice.
Not yet.
Maybe one day. But you know, right now, that's not our focus. That's not our bread and butter. So that's why I encourage people to email you because we will try to tell you honestly what we think is, you know, your best path, right? In terms of who you should talk to. We are a good option, I think, long-term for anybody with a bunch of 1099 kind of stuff that isn't in the S-Corp range where you should do that. I think S-Corps is a hot take, Sam. I think S-Corps are oversold, kind of like short-term rentals.
I totally agree.
Kind of like how short-term rentals are oversold. Somebody made a point, which is correct, I guess, that you know you have the 100-hour material participation rule where there's some loopholes, right, with the short-term rentals where you can spend more time than anybody else, but it can be a lower amount of time. I don't know. I think that there's probably, I'm not saying this is the case of this particular person, right? But I would argue in the short-term rental space, there is very likely a lot of people skirting the rules and hoping they don't get audited. Do you know what I mean? Do people really spend, if they're spending, you know, 150 hours a year, are they really spending more time in that unit than the person on their cleaning team that shows up every week? Are you really making sure that you're monitoring everybody's hours religiously where you can make sure that person doesn't show up every time so they don't have more hours than you? You know what I mean? I think that some of this short-term rental stuff is kind of like, I hope I don't get caught. I hope I don't get audited. And if you don't get audited, then it's like, great, it worked.
Well, people do this actually, so this is another great point. Schedule Cs, people trying to take expenses that are not legitimate expenses. They're not ordinary and necessary. And then they just report it to us and expect us to sign our name right on a return. I'm like, you're going to get audited and we are going to IRS jail.
Well, it's like, well, I mean, an IRS jail is not the same thing as jail, right? Just to be clear, no. It would be a civil situation versus a criminal situation. Like we said, like if you don't report your income, that's actual jail. And if you put something that shouldn't be on your return, then that's something you don't want to get into, but it's civil versus criminal. But yeah, like we have people that try to put their student loan payments on their Schedule C as an expense to deduct it.
Can't do it.
Can't do it. Like, sorry, like that we didn't make the rule, the IRS did. Sometimes we have a couple people who are like, oh, I found this new strategy that like saves me more money than you said that I was going to save. And it's like, That's because you can't do that legally. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, upload what TurboTax told you. We'll go through it line by line, go through the discrepancies. And that's what it's going to come down to, is you did something you weren't supposed to, probably.
Right. So
I actually see a really good question here. That's a mistake I've seen. Someone's asking about amending from MFS to MFJ. I have seen, and maybe this isn't a lot right now, but two or three that were done incorrectly, where that MFS to MFJ was not done and it resulted in a tax notice. The correct procedure is you don't amend both people. You pick one spouse and you amend that spouse from separate to joint. And there's a specific way you have to report the original income and the taxes paid. And a lot of our DIYers just didn't do it correctly. And so then they had to deal with the notices and they didn't get the refund that they wanted.
One thing I want to do real quick is talk some good news. Can I talk about some good news, Sam?
Oh, please.
No, it's good tax news. It might not be good news for our country because it's going to increase the deficit, but like the SALT tax changes for 2025, 2026 are a big change for a lot of clients.
This is going to impact a lot of our clients. If I had to guess right now, I'd say probably half.
So if you just say hypothetically, what was your AGI in 2025? Let's pretend you got two pharmacists married to each other, 300,000 total AGI. Let's say that they have state income tax, property tax combined. Let's say they paid, I don't know, 20,000, something along those lines. Let's say that they paid 25,000 in mortgage interest in 2024. No, I think I need to update some of these year numbers, but the math is still correct. So now let's say your income is 300,000 and your mortgage interest. So in other words, let's assume a sort of an unchanged situation. This is going to save you more money because you're able to take a higher state and local income tax deduction. That's basically the gist of it, right? So the state and local income tax deduction was capped at $10,000 for W-2 1099 folks. I think it's up to $40,000,
which is huge if you live in a state like California, because you're paying a ton in state taxes, probably a lot in property taxes as well.
Yeah. And it's not just for people that live in states with an income tax either. If you live in Texas, if you live in Florida, or, you know, you also have property taxes. That's something to think about.
Taxes, yeah.
Yeah. And also, I believe sales tax is an option too in those states that you can look at, right? In terms of like, you know, you buy a new car, right? You paid a bunch of sales tax. That's relevant in terms of looking at that deduction amount.
The IRS does give you like a de minimis amount. So we do already put that on those clients' returns. But if you think your amount's going to be higher, if you made a big purchase, we can always do a comparison. We had one client, I'm not even kidding, this year, she had a spreadsheet. I forgot how many receipts she saved, 500 receipts to total up a sales tax. And she still couldn't itemize. She still had to take the standard deduction. So that wasn't necessarily worth her time. Probably not worth your time to do something like that. But if you have a big purchase, that's worth noting.
Well, in the big scenario version of this, if somebody is making 500,000 of AGI, and let's say your property taxes, state and local income taxes are, you know, 40,000, and you had 30,000 of mortgage interest, you're just barely itemizing in the scenario of last year. But then if you've got that same income and very large property, state and local income tax, mortgage interest in 2026, you could save 10 grand with this potentially. So I think a lot of our clients are going to save anywhere from a couple thousand to several thousand because of changes on the caps for state and local income taxes. And that does phase out too, right? Like, so one reason for good tax planning is that state and local deduction kind of gets phased down. I think it's to 10, right? Down from 40.
The old rules.
Once you have a high AGI. So like, that's another good reason to focus on like pre-tax contributions, things like that, to keep your taxable income below a certain level so you can maximize the SALT tax deduction. That's another big one for this 2025 tax year.
Yeah, that's a strategy. We've had several clients in the, what you're describing, we call it the tax torpedo when you're in the 500 to 600 range, and some of them have self-employment incomes. We're like, do a solo K, get below that phase out, get the full SALT cap.
Yeah. Let's see if anybody has any sort of last minute questions in the chat. One thing that I am a little concerned about is people putting dependents on certain tax returns. With the family size definitions, there's still some regulations we're awaiting, because the SAVE plan defined family size with the regulations from the Biden administration and very specifically, but all those regs are thrown out. And part of the settlement is they have to come out with new regs in response to that being thrown out. So the definition of family size for people that are on IBR might change, and we're not really sure how it's going to change. So,
A prophylactic move for most of our clients, we have been putting the dependents on the taxpayer with student loans if there's only one. And sometimes what happens is the other spouse is the one that made a dependent care FSA contribution, so they're going to be taxed on that. I still think that's worth it because they're still saving payroll tax on that contribution. And if they amend it later, then it's extra, not a big deal. So I think we're taking steps just to put our student loan borrowers in a good position.
We do have some tax calculators for SLP Wealth clients that you can talk to with your tax manager, or, well, and if it's with your planner, it's going to be at a high level. If you want to go into detail, it can be with your tax manager if you're a tax client of ours. But we have stuff for like 1099 versus W-2 calculators. We have stuff for like helping people kind of think through the S-Corp decision about should I or shouldn't I. Solo 401ks, you know, so we've got a good number of calculators that we can help people think through things. Also like the tax bomb calculator, we can help people think about that. I saw one question was essentially about the tax bomb. You know, what are some strategies I could use to mitigate my tax bomb situation? One thought I've got, Sim, is just be aware of your marginal tax bracket. So like if you get a big boom of bonus income in a particular year, and that's going to push you into a super high tax bracket, if you're ever going to plan a sabbatical, maybe that's the time to do it, is in the year you get your tax bomb happening, so you're in a lower tax bracket. You could also look into temporarily moving abroad if that's an option. You know, for tax purposes, you get a foreign income exclusion.
Yeah, you have to be careful with that. You have to be in for a certain period of time. But yeah, you
can. And it might not be worth it because then you might get taxed at a higher rate if you're a tax resident of a different country. So there's all the kinds of things.
1099Cs or the student loan forgiveness will still count though. So even if you're excluding all of your foreign income, yeah, you're still going to get taxed on that student loan forgiveness.
See, that's why you're the tax director, not me. The key thing is, when somebody is coming up on that deadline, I think it would be very wise for somebody to meet with somebody competent to talk about ways to be aware of what that impact might look like if it happens. Planning in terms of, are there any things I can do? Where should I pull the funds from? Should I pull it from my brokerage account? Should I pull it from, heaven forbid, a home equity loan or something like that? What I tell people on tax bomb accounts, the reason why I think long-term they won't happen is because most people have their wealth in their retirement, their home, or their business. Most people don't have six-figure brokerage accounts. The vast majority of people don't. And so that means taking that money and paying that tax is going to be super painful for most people. And eventually, politically, I even think that Republicans are not going to want to charge it. But it has returned. The tax bomb is active, again, as of 2026. And I think the reason it returned is because they want that there, Republicans do, as a way to prevent mass student loan forgiveness. That's the reason, I think, why they did have it come back. But I do think that they're going to get constituent pushback when we see some large 1099Cs with huge tax bills that come with it. And I think my prediction is that they'll change that rule at some point. Or, you know, eventually Democrats probably win power again and they'll, you know, reintroduce that. But definitely worth a good tax planning conversation. If you're at all worried about that happening in the 2020s, you definitely should be talking to someone. Interesting question. Somebody asked, what about like IDR counts? Like now it's kind of a mystery because they took down the IDR payment count tracker. Some people have no idea when their forgiveness date's supposed to happen. If you do a consult with us, you should know. You should get that from a consult with us as to when to expect that. If you are a wealth client, you should talk to your planner about that in your next regularly scheduled financial planning meeting. And a quick and dirty way is just to look at your oldest loan. You know, if you consolidated during the IDR account adjustment, go look at your oldest loan. How long have you had that oldest loan that was not in a period of deferment, right? Because that didn't count for in-school deferment. And then just that's the rough number is how many years you have, if that makes sense. So like you say you've got, you know, a loan you had from undergrad and you had it 5 years, you went back to school for a couple of years, you went back out, you've been out of school 10 years, you consolidated during the IDR account adjustment. Okay, you've got about 5 plus 10, you got about 15 years. You know, and then if you're on the IBR plan, are you on new or old IBR, 20 or 25 years? And then if you're wrap plan, you're 30. And so just subtract the 15 into those numbers. Probably way too technical, Sim. I didn't follow my own advice, right? But
we
you
can't
know,
help it. We love what we do.
Yeah, it's fun to help people. When we started tax, I underestimated how hard it was going to be. There are so many different rules, state agencies, local stuff, cross-state stuff where people move intra-year. And the student loan complexity just adds an enormous amount of complexity to everything else because you're trying to think through, do you file on time? Do you file late? Well, not late, but you know, do you do an extension and then file that way? So I'm really grateful to have you in the chair. You took charge for us last tax season. We've seen a marked improvement in overall client experience in tax with your leadership. And so I'm really grateful to have you in the chair. And you know, one thing I'm proud of is I'm not aware of any group that does more of this than we do. I don't think it exists. I think this is somewhat of a really challenging niche to deal with all the student loan complexity that happens in taxes. So we're excited to be able to provide this, at least for some of our clients, and to be able to get knowledge from that business to be able to share to folks that are not having us do their taxes. I think that's like a blessing too. Do you want to take a stab at any last minute questions?
Let's see. Someone just asked, how do you IDR certify without income or any evidence of income and you live in a community property state? So you see that sometimes with like a stay-at-home parent. Isn't there like a self-certified option where you just say, I have no taxable income?
Yeah, so the problem is the processing with Department of Ed has totally been upended the past year. I would just say in general, alternative documentation of income has been a train wreck the past several months. They've tried to cut Department of Ed. They don't have enough people to process things. Department of Ed has to approve certain things that the servicers do. And they have put the brakes hard on this alternative documentation of income in terms of actually processing it. And we're seeing people who give IRS permission, that they've been processing the people who share IRS authorization to share income data, right? So that's just a little thing to let people know. In general, if you're wanting something to process, give them permission to share with the IRS the data, and then we probably will go through. Couple other questions about limbo versus buyback. Okay, I guess people wanting to know about jointly versus separate with like the buyback complexity going on.
Yeah, for some people, it might make sense to not amend if you need that tax return for buyback. You kind of have to do a comparison, see if it's worth it to miss out on that refund.
Well, in general, though, right? You want to use up all the time that you have. So if you're waiting on buyback, you think it might happen in the next year and you've got 3 years to amend your return.
Yeah, you don't have to amend right away.
Then like you don't have to rush to do it, right? Like sometimes the smart thing to do from a tax situation is just like, if we don't know something, can we buy more time? Yes or no? We've had to deal with this a lot with the IDR recertification stuff. Like, will they or won't they? Like, remember they kept kicking the can down the road and when IDR recertifications were going to be due like years ago? Really every year it felt like. So sometimes we'll do extensions just like strategically to buy more time to try to get more data on what we need to know before we file for somebody. Let's see. Extensions, I believe everybody's got to file an extension, or what's the rule on that? I actually don't know.
You mean when there's two spouses? So the IRS will let you have like one spouse that files on time and another one that's an extension. From our process, how we do it is we tend to want to keep spouses on the same timeline and we will only split them if there's a good reason to do so, because it's just honestly a lot easier to track. Like, okay, they're both on extension. We can track a whole household. But if there's a reason to split, then we will.
Yeah. Somebody asked about pay. Should I stay on it or whatever? We're still
kick you off. That's my opinion. I don't know if you agree.
Well, yeah, we're still waiting on the regs. I mean, like that's kind of the hard thing that we're having to deal with. The timelines for everything are so out of whack. We're waiting on the Save Plan lawsuit regs. We've gotten the final draft of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act regs that have already come out, but that doesn't address a lot of the stuff that was struck down in the Save Plan court case. That's another reason why we talk extensions sometimes, because it just buys us extra time to make sure things are done the right way. So I guess that would be my general advice to people. Now, one thing I want to say, caveat about extensions, before I say extensions are your friend, Sam, you still have to pay the taxes due on time, right?
So yes, and if you don't want any underpayment penalty, you want to get us all of your info. So if we're filing extension, I still want your return done. Like done.
We still need it done, but it's like if we pay all the expected tax that's going to be due on all the different levels that it's going to be due at, then we've got a lot of flexibility. And honestly, from a client perspective, I think it's great too to do an extension, because what happens to tax preparers in February or March? It was actually pretty hard for me to get someone a webinar today. Basically, she's like sacrificing her lunch hour, I think, or something like that. So it's
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like February, March is like, that is not a great time to have a bunch of questions for your tax preparer, even though that's when the taxes are due, just because of how slammed they are. Instead, it's not a bad idea to try to like make sure you're up to date on all the taxes that you owe. And that extension kind of literally buys you that extra leisurely time to have those final conversations with your tax manager or preparer in, you know, May, June, July, August, where things are way slower, the pace is slower, they're more rested, they're more relaxed. Do you know what I mean? You know.
Yeah, just so you guys know what to expect if you're a tax client, all of our tax clients get a Loom walkthrough of their tax return and an email summary. Yes, it's AI generated, but we fill in the information. So we just want it to look pretty. And then everyone is also getting a link to their tax manager's calendar, so you can right away schedule your tax planning meeting. And I do recommend you schedule that, because we want to make sure we meet with you and you're not getting five-figure refunds again.
So one person asked, we have a farm and a business. Do we need to get those prepared first and come to the remainder? In general, always ask Sim at slpwealth.com. S-I-M, right? Like SIM card. Is that what you say, Sim?
So like a SIM card. Yeah, because there's some Schedule Fs we can do and some that may be too complicated. So I always like to look at your prior year return if that activity existed, and then I can talk through with you if it's something we can do. And if not, I have referrals.
We have a very good idea now that we've been in the business for 3 years about what is in our wheelhouse and what's not. Like the first season, you know, in some ways, we weren't fully understanding of what we were walking into in all circumstances. So an example I remember is a cost basis issue for an inherited timberland trust or something like that. And that was just like, okay, this needs to go to a separate firm. We're not the best place to handle something like this. That's what's nice is like, we know what we can do well on, and we can always just share our thoughts when you ask us. I'm proud of the niche we've carved out within this space, and exciting to be excited to provide some guidance to people at a high level. Again, we are not taking on tax clients today. We are open to hearing that you're interested, or just, this is my situation. What would you recommend? Should I talk to a tax preparer? Should I try to find somebody? Those kind of questions we would welcome. Sim at slpwealth.com. The cost for the tax prep, we have an onboarding fee.
Currently, because we're in crunch time, if I make a one-off exception, the onboarding fee is $9.95, but our normal onboarding fee is $4.95. So we have like a...
Right. I think generally the way we do it is we onboard people at the end of the calendar year at that lower onboarding fee. We charge the onboarding fee because we want people to have skin in the game so that they are committed to wanting to use us long-term, frankly, because it's just not worth it to take on a client for one season for either side, really. It's just kind of a pain in the butt for everybody.
Or to have someone pay us for 3 months to do a complicated return and then cancel. Because we on purpose, we don't want to lock people in. We want to work with people who want to work with us.
And we learned that lesson the hard way. And it's $199 a month ongoing. So if you think about that yearly cost, $2,400 a year, that's not cheap. You could definitely find places that are cheaper. But again, the reason it's cheaper, my view, is because it's more the volume play, right? Somebody who's doing 500 returns and they're pumping them out, and there's not a lot of strategy. There's not a lot of stuff that's carefully looked at, especially as it relates to student loans. And that's why we charge what we charge. I would say, Sim, if you go look at some other pricing on like some popular marketplaces online that some professionals will be subscribed to or follow, that $2,400 a year price is very cheap compared to some places.
We did a really extensive like cost analysis. We compared ourselves to other firms, looked at what our offering was, and we're not the cheapest game, but we're by no means expensive for what we're doing.
The Four Seasons costs the Four Seasons price. As long as you're staying in a Holiday Inn or above, you're going to have a great experience. So that's what we try. You know, I'm just joking around. But if you have complexity around student loans and you don't have inherited timberland trusts or S corp returns that you need to be done or something like that.
I think that's the other thing we changed. We changed a lot of processes since April 16th. And we also we do better vetting of our clients and the people we bring onto our team. The last CPA we brought onto our team, I specifically asked him in the interview, what is your experience with California notices? And he had experience with California notices. So there you go. We know what questions to ask for now.
Yeah. It's not a separate fee from the filing costs. We do have a cover ourselves kind of thing in the contract where we say basically, you know, for complex situations, we can charge, I think it's a $199 per hour fee or something like that.
Yeah, we outline those complexities, but most of our clients aren't subject to that.
Most situations are covered.
Yeah.
For example, if somebody's got multiple rental LLCs, right, or somebody's got multiple states, like three or more states or something like that. People have some weird situations, right? Like they're doing locum tenens and they've got five different states in their return. And you're like,
multi-states can get very complicated quickly.
Right. Thank you for listening to that webinar and my unorthodox episode for today's Student Loan Planner podcast. If you want to talk about high level strategies for student loans and just getting the basic answers of like, what do I do this tax season with my student loans? If you are not an SLP Wealth client, just go to studentloanplanner.com/book and book a consult with one of our student loan experts. That is more than adequate to get a bunch of different kind of questions answered as it relates to your taxes and your student loans to know what to do with this big major upcoming transition for a lot of people to the wrap plan and also basically locking in on of people onto the IBR plan. So if you need a consult, studentloanplanner.com/book. Like I mentioned in the webinar, we don't have space for tax clients at the moment, with this tax season, we're fully committed. But I will say that when we do have space, we're going to make it available to SLP Wealth Financial Planning clients. we do have to have you be an SLP Wealth financial planning client for you to be able to get the tax services because of how integrated the two services are and how it's really built to be a one-stop shop. So if you would eventually maybe like to get tax services added on, if you're already an SLP Wealth client, just let your advisor know you'd love to get on that wait list. And then if you would like to eventually be on the wait list, the best thing to do would be to simply go become an SLP Wealth financial planning client so that you can get access to that service when we open it up again for new clients. Assuming, of course, you're interested. And the link for that is pretty straightforward. It's just slpwealth.com. And then just click on the Get Started link anywhere on that website, and it'll take you to the page to sign up and try out SLP Wealth. Thank you all so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I hope you have a great rest of your day.